I thought we'd kick it off tonight with a little bit of Christmas music in the background. So as we get things rolling here tonight, I need to turn that off. I'm getting a lot of feedback for some reason. I don't know where that's coming from, but it never fails. It's always something. We're here again on a Tuesday night. We're glad you're with us here tonight. And I had to kill that music. Sorry, guys. I was getting feedback in my deal here for some reason. Anyway, we are gathered here tonight. Welcome to the Mead House. First thing we want to do is introduce everybody. Ryan Richardson in the house. Aaron Martin along for the ride. Mississippi Chris Spencer. He's going to be talking about something very special coming around Christmas time here for our listeners. Jeff Schaus is in the house. My name is J.D. Webb. Welcome again to the Mead House. And usually about this time, we like to mention people's names, and I've been turning to Jeff. Jeff's been cruising around the Facebook pages and looking for interesting things to bring up. Jeff, what have you found this week?
I've got a couple quick shout-outs this week. From the Mead Group, I have Brent Tennant had a couple capsaicinols on there, one with some ancho chilies, he says was a mild kind of spicy for the weaklings. And then the one he was really proud of was a chipotle mead. He had it, said it had a great smoky flavor and a really good amount of heat to it. Sounded really delicious. So glad to hear about that. That sounds like coming up with some really interesting concoctions.
Ancho chilies, huh?
Ancho chilies.
Wasn't that the one we got from Ricky from Groenfell? Wasn't that one made with ancho chilies?
Yeah, that was ancho chili and cocoa, or chocolate.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. Interesting. Okay. Anxious to hear about that one too, Jeff. Go ahead.
And then another one that I wanted to throw out from Tom Rapus on the Mead Makers group, he had a really interesting post that I was kind of nerding out over regarding some taste testing, where he was trying to hone in on the amount of a tannin for one of the red piments he was working on. He and his wife set up essentially just a tannin solution and some different combinations and did a little taste test of their own to see which one they like, try to dial in the amount of flavor in there. And then when they got between two that they were really liking, they set up a second taste test with both of those and then a middle-of-the-road concentration. So they could test those out a little bit further. Really great method, really interesting discussion. I mean, go check that out. He goes into a lot more detail than I can go into here. Really worthwhile.
Which group is that?
That was the Mead Makers group.
Mead Makers. Perfect. Okay.
And Tom's a pretty active guy on there, so a lot of good information from him. Then the last one I had for tonight comes from the Mead Group again. Guy named Eugene Stover is asking about a black raspberry coffee mead that he did, and it looks like he has a lot going into this. He starts with some black raspberry jam, some Tanzanian peaberry coffee, like the brewed coffee, along with some of the coffee beans. And then in secondary later, it sounds like he added more of the black raspberry jam, a little more coffee, and then I believe some more honey as well to keep it going. Now he says it tastes really great. He's really loving it, but a lot of the people that he's letting taste it are getting this ashtray nose and taste to it when they're trying it out, and he's wondering where that might come from. What do you guys think about that?
Ashtray.
Mm-hmm.
That's an unusual descriptor.
Yeah. Gosh. that's a good one there.
Did he use whole berries at all?
Yes, I believe he was using the. I'm not sure if he used whole berries. He said he used a jam made from the berries themselves, but it sounds like he also let it sit on some whole coffee beans.
Yeah, I'm gonna guess it's got something to do with a vegetal character. A really strong vegetal character might come across in that way. So that could come from berry seeds or the coffee beans either. That'd be my guess.
You said he used a berry jam?
Right.
Did he add a whole lot of pectic enzyme to it before he started fermenting, I wonder?
You know, I don't see a lot of...
Typically, now it depends on the berry. There are some berries out there that you really don't need to add pectin in order to make jam. But I think most people do. So, I mean, the whole idea with pectic enzyme, of course, is to break down the pectins, the cells, structures in the fruit itself. Going to be kind of difficult to do, I would think, if you're using jam, because you're actually adding to the pectin. You're adding more pectin at that point. Hey, so I don't know if that would have something to do with it.
Guys, are any of you, is your audio kind of choppy?
No.
Just me?
I hear everybody fine.
Everything's
same choppy. Here.
Yeah,
you guys, you hearing everybody fine? Chris, I can dump you and call you back if you want.
Yeah, do that. Let's see if we can get a better connection.
Sure. All right, little audio problems here, but hey, you know what? This is a $2 show. We don't have a budget, and so bear with us. We try to get Chris back here. And I really don't. I don't want to do this without Chris. But
okay. Can you hear me?
Yes, sir. Can you hear us?
Much better.
Okay. All right. Yeah. Well, yes. Yeah. You know, sometimes Aaron's got that same problem. He'll connect, and everything just goes south, and we'll hang up on him and call him back, and everything's perfect. So, hey,
we're good now.
Welcome to the internet. This is Al Gore's fault. He invented the internet. So,
mm-hmm. Like,
but anyway,
climate change.
Yeah. Yeah. The political show starts immediately after this one. So, I was talking about, the one thing that I caught right off the bat, if he's using jam, guys, is the pectic and the pectic enzyme thing. If you're making jam, you know, most people throw in some pectin during the cookdown in order to make jam. So it's kind of it seems like you'd be adding to the problem at that point. And I don't know if that's responsible for the smell or the taste of the ashtray thing that he's getting, but that's my only thought on it.
Well, it does sure seem like you would need to compensate for the pectin and the jam, because you're right. Generally, you need that to set the jam right in the first place.
Yeah.
You know, and the one thought I'm having too, I don't know how roasted or roasty of a coffee he used, but maybe if it was, you know, very, very toasted, roasty coffee, like a dark roast, maybe that could be perceived by some as kind of like a burned ashtray type of a flavor as well. Just spitballing there. But yeah, that's a new descriptor for me. I've not really heard that before when describing needs.
Yeah. It was pretty unique to me too, so I kind of thought I'd throw it you guys' direction.
Doesn't sound like a whole lot of help coming from the Mead House here tonight, but hey, at least we gave it our best shot. So, you know, I'd like to hear more about it. If we can, you know, if he's watching the show or watching, this is radio, guys. If he's listening to the show, maybe he can give us some more detailed feedback and let us know what's going on with it. Anything else, Jeff?
That's what I had for this evening.
Perfect. What are we drinking tonight, guys? Aaron, what's in your glass tonight?
Yeah, tonight I am drinking one of my new favorite beers. This is a beer from Ballast Point Brewing Company, and it's called Victory at Sea. It's a porter brewed with coffee and vanilla, and I'll tell you guys, it's that time of year here in Wisconsin. It's like 6 degrees outside. It is cold as can be, and I've just really been on like a porter and stout kick the last couple of weeks. Just something about this time of year is conducive to that. So it's really smooth. It's got a very nice, pleasant coffee flavor going on as well. And if you guys see this on the shelf, I would definitely recommend picking up a six pack of it.
That sounds good. Jeff, what's in the cup tonight?
Ooh, so I know we've mentioned on the show a time or two Dragon's Milk by New Holland Brewing.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
I'm drinking one of those, but I'm drinking something different. I found this, believe it or not, in the clearance section of my local liquor store. It's a Dragon's Milk Reserve. It's their bourbon barrel stout, but they've brewed it with raspberry and lemon.
Oh, wow. Raspberry Ooh. And lemon?
Raspberry and lemon.
Wow.
And, okay. You know, you guys that have had Dragon's Milk know that it's a pretty strong stout flavor.
Yeah.
But there's actually a pronounced enough fruit flavor to this that it really comes through. And I am surprised at how well they blend, to be perfectly honest.
Wow. Wow,
what were the fruits again you said, Jeff? Was it
raspberry and lemon?
Raspberry and lemon, huh?
That's an odd combination, I think. Wow, interesting. We get Dragon's Milk out here. I'm going to have to see if I can locate the reserve and see if I can't get my hands on it. Mississippi, what kind of beer are you drinking tonight?
Oh, I'm trying out a... he was drinking New Holland. I'm drinking New Belgium, Fat Tire. It's a Fat Tire.
Fat Tire.
It's an amber ale. And,
amber ale.
Thought I'd give it. Yeah, I almost didn't have anything to drink. I had a really odd day. I was watching the Home and Garden TV show channel, and I kind of got in the arts and crafts mood, so I decided to make some Christmas stockings, but I got kicked out of the fabric store, so
is that an after the show discussion, or
I mean, it was all a misunderstanding. I mean, I went in and the lady said, "Can I help you?" And I said, "Can I get felt here?" And I think she took it the wrong way.
And too many beers.
So I went beer shopping and I found this Fat Tire. So
only from Mississippi, I swear. Chris has been on a mission with beer. He's this kind of ties into the whole Braggot thing that we've got going. I think we, you know, because early when we first started doing a show, guys, Chris is just not a beer drinker. He likes his wine and his mead. Since we started doing this Braggot thing, he's been on this tear. He's been brewing beer. He's been drinking beer. And I think he's looking for that perfect combination for a Braggot.
Good since stuff, I didn't Chris. Make my stockings, I went beer shopping.
Ryan, what are you drinking tonight, bud?
I'm drinking the Ace of Cascades from Boss Meadery in Madison, Wisconsin.
Heck yeah.
It is, you have this one, Aaron?
I have had that one. Please continue, but I've got a story to tell about that one.
It's a hopped mead. It's got some nice label art. It's got skull and crossbones, except the crossbones are your bee dippers, or sorry, your honey, whatever you call those, you know, the you put in your honey jar. It says this hopped up sparkling session mead is made with Cascade and Willamette hops. It's 6.5% ABV. It's got a lot of honey character. I don't have my hydrometer, so I, you know, here where I'm sitting, so I don't know what the gravity is on it, but it seems to be pretty dry. It's got some great hop character, some great honey character, and just enough hops. I mean, it's cold right now, so maybe we should check in a little later in the show and see as it comes up to room temperature if any more of those hops come out. But with that, Aaron, let's hear what your drunken story about Boss Meter.
So actually, if you guys remember, maybe a couple of months ago, we took a vacation, kind of a tour around the state of Wisconsin, and one of our stops was in Madison. And we had the chance to visit the Boss Meadery. We met with Colleen Boss, the mead maker there, and had a really nice time. But actually, that mead was the very last one that I had of the night there. And just as a tip, the way that they suggested that they serve it was actually over lemon sherbet. So it was kind of like an ice cream drink. And that was just out of this world. Like the
sherbet?
Nice. Yeah. Wow. Lemon sherbet with the hop flavor, the honey flavor all going on. It was really, really good.
Wow. Kind of reminds me a little bit about a little dessert cocktail or whatever you want to call it that my family does on colder, typically it's in the winter. You take a cordial glass and you put just a little bit of vanilla ice cream in that cordial glass, and then you fill it up with amaretto.
Ooh.
And that's it.
And that's it.
Sounds tasty.
Good stuff. Well, I'm drinking a bourbon barrel stout tonight as well, guys. This one happens to be from Anderson Valley in Boonville, California. Just found this one on the shelf at, I think it was BevMo. It's a bourbon barrel stout aged in Wild Turkey bourbon barrels. It's definitely a stout, but I don't get the bourbon until right at the very end, and it's just ever so slight. Not enough for me. It's a good beer. I don't know that I'd buy it again because it's labeled bourbon. If it was just labeled stout, I could live with that and probably buy it again. But because it says bourbon on it, just not getting a sufficient amount of bourbon for me to make me want to go buy it again. It comes in right at the very end. And of course, that's that Wild Turkey coming in there. So that's what old JD is drinking tonight. Now, remember we had Ricky the Mead Maker on the show here a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about the way that they do things there at Groenfell. And recall when he said that they brew their mead at 86 degrees. You remember that?
How could we forget?
We all kind of sat back and went, what? or more to the point, what the hell? So Chris and I think both of us have been pretty eager to want to try this thing out. So I went ahead and did it. Now, I also recall that he was doing a sizer, the one that he had sent us. He made the comment that he only used 10% juice, apple, in his sizer, which was pretty amazing because I got the apple taste out of that sizer that he sent. So I thought, well, why don't we add some tart cherry juice to this experiment? So it's basically this simple, okay? A little over a pound of wildflower honey with 16 ounces of pure tart cherry juice. Brought the water, all the liquid, all of that came up to 1 gallon. I adjusted to reach a gravity of 1.060, pretty low, and hoping to make this about an 8% mead or so, 8.5%, using D47. I threw in a heaping teaspoon of Fermade K right up front and D47 yeast, and this thing is going to blow your mind. Fermenting at 82 degrees. So today, for the past couple of days, it's been at about 1.022. Chris made a comment before we went live tonight. He thinks it might be because of it needs more nutrient. I mean, D47, as you know, it chugs right along quickly. I added yesterday. I also added another 8 ounces of cherry juice. I warmed it up to 82 degrees because I tasted it and zero cherry right off the bat. Now remember, this is supposed to be done in 3 weeks. This is supposed to be in the bottle and on the shelf in 3 weeks. So that's what we're shooting for. So we're stuck at 1022. Do I add more, do I try to jump start it and throw in some more nutrient, or what do you guys think?
I would check the pH also.
Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. What did it start at again, JD?
1.060. Remember, this is going to be a low alcohol, low by, typical mead standards. We're looking at around 8% or so. So we need this to finish out right down at the bottom. So, somewhere around 1.000 or below.
Yeah, and right now, you're at about, you said 1.022.
Yeah.
And you
taste about 5%.
Yeah, yeah. What's the sweetness like on that when you just hear to the taste?
It's not. Yeah, when I tasted it yesterday, it's not sweet. It's not sweet. It's very It's very different. I can taste it. It's getting there. Okay. There's a dryness to it that's coming along. Not quite there yet, but I really don't get a lot of sweet out of it at all. And there was no cherry flavor. So.
It's entirely too early to judge anything with flavor, and at least until fermentation is complete. I would definitely be checking the pH, and that'd be the first thing. And then I would look at maybe the nutrients next.
Yeah. This was started, if I can get my notes here. I just started this just a few days ago. So it's still, it's very young. I want to say.
Keep this in mind, JD. You know, you've been sort of calling me for advice whenever you started a new mead, and you've sort of went down my path with the 71B, and you may have gotten used to that. 71B is a workhorse. I mean, it will fight through low pH, low nutrients, all sorts of things, high starting gravities. But now you're working with something entirely different. And D47 is a workhorse yeast also, but there's going to be differences as to what it'll tolerate. And I can tell you right now, there's not very many yeasts that will tolerate the things that 71B will. So maybe you've gotten low on nutrients, or your pH has dropped. Maybe the cherry juice had enough acid in it or something.
Yeah, it could be. I mean, I can take a pH reading and check on it, but go ahead.
You know, JD, one of my calls with Ricky, just setting up our interview with him, I joked that I go, I'll try not to call your cell phone, you know, and when I'm in the middle of a batch and have a question. And he said, you know, he goes, hey, you wouldn't be the first guy who does that. You know, he goes, there's a lot of guys that call me with problems. You know, if it's something like, you know, we're trying to replicate something he's doing, he might be the guy just to ask, you know, what's going on. I know you've got his number.
Yeah, I do. And I, you know, it's not like I haven't given it a thought, but then I hate to impose on the guy too. But, I just might do it. I did send, I don't have his direct email address. All I have is the one off his website. I sent a couple of them, and I haven't heard anything back. But, of course, that may be some, you know, like info@Groenfell or whatever, where somebody else probably sorts through the emails. I don't know how many they get on a daily basis, but you know, I've got his cell phone number. I could always shoot him a text too, but I'll think about that. In the meantime, Chris, I'll take a pH reading and see where we sit on it. If this thing fails, I'm okay with it. Obviously, we'd like it to come out a winner. But if it doesn't work, it doesn't work. I was leery from the start about the high temps. I got a real problem with that. But hey, I'm willing to give it a shot and give it a try. So, but anyway, so that's the experiment that I've got going based off of what Ricky was talking about. So
now, you know, JD, what were you doing for nutrients?
Fermade K, a teaspoon, just a big teaspoon of Fermade K right up front.
And, you know, what I have on hand is I have, you know, Fermade O is what I've got right now. But I do recall Ricky saying that he liked the Y yeast beer nutrient that he was using. So I wonder if there's something a little bit different in that just kind of, you know, helps that yeast chug along.
Yeah, I don't know.
He did mention he dosed pretty heavily too.
I'm sorry.
You're all right. I was just going to say it sounded like he dosed that at something like an ounce per gallon, or a really high quantity like that. Which, you know, the yeast may take that just fermenting at such a vigorous pace there.
Yeah.
Did you make sure that it was the beer nutrient? Because when I went to look for it, I did notice that Y yeast makes two different nutrients. One's for beer and one's for wine.
Yeah, I did not verify which one. And actually, as I think about it, he just said the Y yeast nutrient, and he was speaking in relation to, you know, how you put so much yeast in beer, you know, and how it seems like with mead, a lot of people ration their yeast, which is funny because beer yeast is $7 a batch and wine yeast is 99 cents a packet. But no, that'd be something else we could verify with them, you know, which ones are using.
Yeah.
Well, for the sake of anything, I can't. None of the three home brew shops here around me carry the Y yeast nutrients. They all carry this Brewcraft stuff, only one of them carries the Fermade brand. It's not a brand. I don't remember what brand it is, but Fermade K. And then they carry this brown paper bag yeast is what I call it. I mean, it's like unlabeled, like they probably get it in a big, huge container and then divvy it up in these little pill containers. And then that's how they sell it. I mean, I have no idea. It just says nutrient, you know, but I don't know what it is.
That was the first thing I ran into, after we had him on the show, because I think it was that night after we got finished. I went bopping off, gonna try it, you know. So I went to Northern Brewer and I typed in Y-East Nutrient, and up come two different ones. And I was like, yeah. Well, damn.
Yeah. Well, we'll keep up with it and, you know, just see what happens. I mean, I got three more packs of D47, plenty of honey, and an extra container that I can get a second one started in. So, so we'll just keep an eye on this one.
And Jamie, I just had two other questions for you on that before we switch over to something new. Have you been degassing that as well?
Oh yes. Oh yes.
Okay.
Oh yeah. Yep. Twice a day. Yep.
Gotcha. And then is there any airlock activity at this point?
No. Very little. I mean, I get up in the morning and there's a bubble sitting in the airlock.
Gotcha.
So, very little.
Okay.
I know it's, I mean, yeah, you know, I can look at the surface and the surface tension, and you can see where it's still fermenting, but not nearly as strongly as it was, because I can still see little bubbles rising up from the bottom and breaking that surface tension. So I know that there's some kind of activity going on, just not a hell of a lot. So nothing measurable. But like I said, we'll keep an eye on it, you know, and see what happens. I mean, it's an experiment. So what the heck?
Absolutely.
Before we get into the to some of the historical things that we wanted to get into tonight on the show, I wanted to throw a shout out to Scott. He jumped on Facebook the other day, and apparently he was listening to our discussion about the graph. Sounds like he's going to get one started. Sent a message via Facebook on our Facebook page. And was wondering about the grains, whether they were crushed or not. And, you know, we didn't really go into a whole lot of discussion on that when we were talking about it. But to anybody who's doing the graph or wants to do that graph, yes, you need to crush the grain in order for it to work. So that was a question that that Scott had. On the Facebook, on our Facebook page, Mike Torrance also sent a message, and he's talking about the cocoa nibs, and it was like Ryan, I believe, but he also soaks his nibs in 100 proof grain neutral alcohol or vodka. To extract the flavors, and he does that with various things apparently, and uses that to add to his projects. So I guess that's another way to add flavorings to your mead, guys. Just to soak it in a grain neutral, something like a vodka, and do it that way.
I've got 4 ounces of nibs and 4 ounces of vodka right now that's going to go in a chocolate milk stout that I'm doing. And, on the graph, let me just say we cracked another bottle tonight, and just to see how it's coming along. And I'm at, if I haven't lost count, I'm at 2 weeks in the bottle. And this thing changes with, I mean, like every 3 or 4 days it changes. Wow. And it'll be good, and then it'll be bad, and then it'll be good again. And it honestly hasn't settled down to a point where I can make an honest judgment on it yet. So I'm thinking that, you know, I may set this stuff aside for another month. Forget about it, just let it do its thing, and before I make a final judgment. But I taste it, And I go, you know, I think I would rather use the 60L instead of the 120. And then I wait a week and I taste it again. And I go, no, I think the 120 was the way to go. And then it's just kind of back and forth. And so it's just changing all the time. So if you make it, don't judge it too early.
Yeah, mine's sitting in a keg right now, being carbonated. who'd we drop? Ryan again. Try to get. All right, we'll have to wait and see. We can get Ryan back here again. All right. And actually, Jeff responded to this one on our Facebook page. This is from Richard Orpen, O-R-P-E-N. He's listens to the show and says he enjoys listening. He made a couple of comments. One in particular about adding vanilla beans. Wanted to know if you sanitize beans or not, Jeff. And I thought you had a pretty interesting reply to him. Do you recall that?
That was a while back. I think I think my advice was something along the lines of you could sanitize them with some vodka or maybe soak them for a little while in some steeping water to kill some of the microbacteria. But really, if you're adding vanilla beans to something that's been fermented for a while, it's not strictly necessary. Because there's a threshold you cross about 7% alcohol by volume in a mead, where at that point you're really inhibiting a lot of the nasty bacteria and stuff that are potentially going to take over and wreck your mead. So usually at that point you can just you can let it sit on the vanilla without much. Much to worry about, really.
Yeah, this was, you're right, it was a while back. It was back in October. I don't know why something popped up on the Facebook page and I clicked on it, and here's these messages sitting there from these different people. But I guess I'll have to just keep keep an eye on that stuff on our Facebook page more often. A while back, this is back in the beginning of our show when we first started. We had a discussion, guys, about difficult fermentations, and Aaron was describing one that he had. I've got it pulled up here. Let's take a listen and see what Aaron's talking about.
Procedure here for any of the home brewers of beer out there. It was a malt extract kit where it involved steeping some specialty grains and then adding in the malt extract for a boil, although I think it was only about a 20 or 30 minute boil as opposed to a full 1 hour boil. And what happened is after the boil at the point when I shut the flame off, that is when I poured in some honey. And this particular difficult fermentation is one that it doesn't seem like it's a real common issue that people run into, and it's really the only time I've ran into it. But it's what I think in Ken Schramm's book, he refers to it as stratification of the must. And this is a situation where the must can actually separate into two distinct layers of two separate viscosities. And that's essentially what happened to me here is, you know, it shot off like a rocket. The braggots that I've done just are very vigorous fermenters that will just clog up your airlocks. And I would strongly recommend a blow-off tube for anybody interested in doing something like this. But after a few days, it just kind of puttered out and separated out into these two distinct layers like that. I think the top layer was a lighter color, and then the bottom layer was a little bit darker of a color. And just following the advice from Ken's book, what I wound up doing was just I gave it a racking, and in doing so, it just kind of blended it up into those two, those two layers kind of blended together into more of a homogeneous mixture at that point, and it just kind of slowly finished out the fermentation from there. It was okay. I wonder if maybe it also had picked up some kind of a contaminant as well. This particular batch came out with just a little bit of an off flavor or sour type of a flavor afterwards. But that was, and it was okay. It wasn't definitely not my best work, but drinkable no less. But to me, that was one of the more difficult fermentations that I've experienced.
And Aaron, have you seen that since?
I have not. No, I haven't. I'm just tickled that you pulled that up. When I saw in the email string that you wanted to revisit that topic, I was excited because with this whole Braggot thing that we've been doing, I was interested to see if any of you guys encountered that with any of your Braggots. Because like I was saying there, that was the only time I encountered it was on that Braggot, which, by the way, JD, that was the Braggot that was like the predecessor or the one right before the one that I sent you the bottle of. I have not had that happen to me since that one problematic batch.
Chris, have you, did you notice anything like that at all with your Braggot?
No, because I used my Leaster on it. You know, when I started looking into this whole beer brewing thing for the Braggots, I kind of deduced that the way I preach about temperature control with mead, I think aeration before you pitch your yeast is sort of the same thing with beer. To get the best healthy fermentation in a beer muss or in a beer wort, you really got to get some oxygen in there. And so I beat the crap out of it with a drill. And so I most definitely didn't have any problems with things not mixing.
Yeah, and I really couldn't say because the Braggot that I did was so dark you wouldn't have been able to tell anyway. The one I did was using stout grains for a porter stout. So the resulting must or wort is very dark. So I wouldn't be able to tell if it happened or not, Aaron. But
okay.
Well, that's good. You haven't noticed anything since, but you did have another problem as well. Let's listen to this piece about bathroom smells.
I remember
this. I'll tell you an experience that I've had, and this was actually a batch of a peach melomel that I made maybe a year or so ago. And this was before I had stumbled across the meadmaderight.com website and had really been exposed to Fermade O or Fermade K. This was back in the dark ages where I was still using, I don't even know what it was, whatever, packets of yeast nutrients and yeast energizers that my local homebrew supply shop sells. And this was even in the dark ages where I wasn't really tailoring the amount of nutrients to use based on things like batch size or starting gravity. So I suspect that I added more nutrients to this batch than what was needed. And to me, this is going to sound kind of gross, but it kind of like left a little bit of a weird like a bathroom smell to it, or like almost like a uriny smell. And I know that sounds really disgusting, but
especially like, on radio. Yeah.
Especially on radio, yeah. So
well, Aaron, the DAP is it's a urea based. Now don't misunderstand what I'm saying here, because there are some purely urea based things that are not even, I don't think they're even allowed to be used on a commercial scale. But if I'm not mistaken, I believe that the DAP is a urea based nitrogen, or at least part of it, I think. Now I may be wrong about that.
And so Chris comes back in and says, yeah, the DAP that you use is urea-based. That made us all feel good.
Who is the redneck guy there talking?
Here we are putting urine in our batches of mead. But anyway, Chris, have we been able to be definitive about DAP? Is it really a urea-based? And did that result, you think, in the bathroom smell that Aaron was talking about?
I don't know if it resulted in it or not, but it is a urea-based. That's where the nitrogen comes from, is the urea base. So if he overfed it, yeah, I mean, you know, I'm very sensitive to DAP anyway. I'm one of the few who can taste it if there's any left over. So,
and is that when you taste that DAP? Is that what you're tasting? Is that what you're getting out of that? Or
no, it's more of a metallic kind of a chemical metallic taste.
Yeah, Aaron, have you had any of that problem since then?
Fortunately, I can say I have not.
How about anybody else? Well, go ahead.
I was just going to say, even with that peach one that I was describing there, over time, it's really improved as well. I think when it was young, not only would I have described it as kind of a urea or bathroom type flavor and smell going on there, but I wasn't getting any peach either. And over time, as it's aged, the peach flavor has returned to it, and you can really notice that that's there now. So I guess the lesson learned for me is that, you know, they always say it with mead, when in doubt, age it out.
Yeah. I've got a peach project going that it's just sitting on the back burner for now. I'm not going to touch it. It's going to turn out to be a very dry peach, I'm just gonna let it sit. I do recall you talking about it earlier. I remembered this show, and again, these are shows, I mean, we're going way back, probably somewhere in the first 10 shows when you were talking about that particular peach mead. But I do remember talking about that, and Chris seems to be my go-to guy now. He's given me quite a bit of advice based off his own experiments that he's done, and he warned me about the peach thing. So it's coming along, and I'm just gonna let it sit on the back burner and just let it, keep the airlock full and just kind of let it do its thing. We'll give it. Hell, if it takes a year, it takes a year. So, hopefully good things will come around as we let it age. Jeff joined the show. I was cruising around a Facebook page, and I noticed this guy, Jeff Schaus. He had gone on about doing this big experiment about using different kinds of yeast, and he had just about every kind of combination that you could think of going on. Later on, as it turns out, we learned that Jeff is actually the third best mead maker in the world. Let's listen to Jeff here for a minute. Yeah, Jeff, the third world's best mead maker in the world. What was the feedback?
Well, this was part of my consternation, is that I really didn't get a lot of feedback. The third best mead in the world made it through two rounds. The first round, I got no feedback whatsoever, other than just the scores and the little ticks as to what flavors they detected. There was no like actual comments written down on the sheet. And the second round, there was a little bit more. there was some comment of, you know, some age would improve this. This is a young mead, and that's fair. It's a little less than a year old, so it's still, you know, it's still aging up to where it ought to be. But yeah, that was really all the commentary I got on that. And that was a little bit, you know, frustrated when I opened up my score sheets, because to me, it's all well and good, you know, winning medals and little cups and everything. But the reason I started getting into competing in these was not to win medals or to, you know, to win awards and stuff. It was really to get feedback from people that are, you know, more knowledgeable in this area than I am, because, you know, pretty much since I started brewing, my main feedback other than my own palate has been, you know, friends and family. And, you know, really, I don't think I've, according to them, I don't think I've ever brewed a bad mead.
Yeah, and
it's all been fantastic.
They're not going to lie to you and tell you your mead tastes like crap either, are they? Okay. Back with Jeff. Jeff, you know, it turns out you went through the process. You became a judge. How important is it giving that feedback? You kind of found out through your own, competing, how important it is. But how do you personally feel about it as being a judge, giving that feedback?
You know, I, granted, I've not had a lot of opportunity to use my judge qualification, but in the couple rounds of judging that I have done this year, I always tried to make it a point to point out, you know, the things that I liked about, the quality I was asked to be judging, as well as the things that I didn't like. And I think that's fair. I think when people submit a mead to a competition, they're looking for objective feedback and they want to know what they can do to improve it. Now, if you remember from this episode, this was about the Mazer Cup, and we're talking about a competition that judges something in the order of 450 different, like, homebrew meads in a single day. So right. I get that the judges don't have a lot of time for each individual mead. Yeah. And it's frustrating, but that's fine. They have a lot on their plate, and that's understandable.
Yeah.
As a side note to this, the Mazer Cup was in March, and we're in December. We've been on the air for a while.
Yep. Yep. Yeah. 30. I think this is 33 shows. Tonight marks 33 shows. So, and we do one a week, and we've been off a couple.
Didn't
of
mean
weeks,
to. So. Yeah, I didn't mean to get off the subject there, Jeff. I just had to point that out.
Oh, you're right.
Yeah, hey, you know, whatever works here. This is basically a scriptless show, so whatever comes to your mind. And that's what's fun about this, you know, about doing this show, is nothing is scripted. You know, we have some brief show notes that we toss around, kind of give us a, you know, here's what we're going to start out, but many times we kind of wander off and talk about something completely different. So I think that's the cool thing,
Jeff,
about it.
Yeah, it is. It's the best. I want to ask Jeff, though, as a judge, I send in my entry, and you're assigned to taste it, okay? And you get it, and it's not right up your alley. It's not the kind of thing that you want to be drinking. It's probably too sweet for you, and it's most definitely a dessert mead. So how do you approach giving me feedback on something that you personally don't like, but it may be appropriate for the style?
Well, and here's the wonderful thing about the program that the BJCP has set up. And I'm not going to say that the BJCP is, you know, all knowing and wonderful. There are some fair criticisms, and some, you know, people have raised against them that I think, that's okay. But one thing they do really well is that they give you these broad categories with style descriptions, and the multifaceted ways that a beer could fit into this style, the things to look for when you're judging it, and the things that would be counted as a fault. And You know, I think a great example of that, I was judging a beer this past summer for a local competition that's, I can never pronounce this name right.
Goza.
Thank you. There it is. Not my favorite kind of beer. I don't like sea salt flavor in a beer. But, you know, it was very well executed. There were two real standout beers on that flight that I judged, which was historical styles beer. The other one was a root beer stout. And the only reason that root beer stout didn't win is because there really is no established criteria for what a root beer should taste like as a beer flavor. So it got really high marks, but the Gosa had to take the win. And you know, it scored really, really highly, despite me not particularly liking the style of beer. Because it met all the criteria, what it was looking for. And even I have to admit, for a style of beer I don't like, it was very nicely executed. I'd love to say that all judges are that objective about it and can kind of look past personal preference. From my experience, not all of them have. I've definitely disagreed with some comments. But this whole judging and competition system is still a fantastic way to get very objective feedback from other people that are experienced in this field. And I highly recommend, you know, there is the Mazer Cup. There's a few other really big mead competitions, but almost every major city has a homebrew club. And most of these homebrew clubs will sponsor a yearly event that may or may not include mead. I mean, look at it. I mean, get involved. These are great opportunities to get some objective feedback, meet more people that are interested in brewing stuff, and just generally, you know, grow as a brewer.
Yeah, I think that's the best way too, because, you know, giving it to your family, I know if it was my family, they'd probably come back and say, what the hell are you trying to do, poison us? So I don't know that you really get, I mean, you have friends and, you know, you give your stuff to your friends or your relatives. I don't know that they really honestly come back with honest feedback. I really think you're probably better off maybe sending it to somebody who's going to be a little more objective, like a judge. So,
it comes down to who matters. Who matters most? Does it matter that you are making something that the majority of people enjoy, or that's true to style?
I'm making it for something that I enjoy. I could care less if anybody. I mean, if somebody else enjoys it, fine. But I'm not making my stuff for other people. I'm making it for me, and that makes a big difference. As far as me personally. But go ahead.
When I make stuff, the only palate more important than mine is my wife's. And that's the way I make it. I know what she likes. I know what I like. And like I said, if other people don't like it, good. They're not going to ask me for it.
Yeah. Or ask you for more. I think Chris has gotten himself stuck in that rut because they keep asking him for more.
Oh yeah, my problem is they go, this stuff wasn't the best you've ever made. Have you got any more?
Yeah. Well, it depends on who you're making it for. I mean, if you want to submit it to a judge and get real good, honest input. You know, I would do that. I'm not looking for trophies. I'm not looking for medals or anything of that nature. I could care less. But what I am looking for is the feedback from a judge. I want to know that, you know, what I'm doing, my processes, my methods are producing some good mead. I guess it's a confidence builder more than anything for me. And I could care less what other, you know, my friends and relatives, I don't care what they think about it. What's important to me is what I think about it. But talking about Chris, we did a show, I think we were talking about some different honeys, and Chris started talking about some honey down in Mississippi. just kind of funny. You really have to know Mississippi, Chris, but let's take a listen to Chris here.
The problem with our honey, as I've said before many times, we're blessed with a really good warm climate, and it's warm here, you know, 325 days of the year.
Yeah.
So
rub it in.
So yeah, but you know, it's great for going swimming, but it's not so great when you've got that many. You know, anything that can grow grows here, and so every flower bed around here has got marigolds. Which are the most bitter, vile thing you ever tasted. Mississippi is the magnolia state. We've got magnolia blossoms everywhere. The most beautiful smelling flower you've ever smelled. Absolutely awful in honey. So we've got lots of pasture land. So we've got a lot of milkweed. We've got a lot of bitterweed. We've got a lot of pasture thistle, which is very bitter. By the way, pasture thistle is a whole other world from star thistle. Star thistle is excellent honey. Pasture thistle, not so much. So if you get local honey from here, you're getting this huge, bitter, sour bomb. It's awful. It's great. It's great to put on your biscuits. It's wonderful table honey. You ferment that stuff down and it's just undrinkable.
Oh, wow.
And it always makes me jealous when I hear people talking from other parts of the country. They talk about, oh, we have the most wonderful local honey. Find your local beekeeper. And I tell everybody around here, avoid your local beekeeper because this is not what you want here.
Chris, just how good is that honey in Mississippi anyway?
I think you just heard the whole story.
Well, you talked about star thistle, this thistle, that thistle. Now, if you live in Mississippi and you want to make mead, you know, Scott Monroe lives down there in Mississippi near you too. So you guys are pretty much limited as far as sourcing honey. You know, with any degree of trying to find something that's usable. So you got to go out of your county, state. I mean, you're stuck.
Yeah, this general area. You know, there's some good honey that comes from over in eastern Tennessee and from the Carolinas up in the mountains. There's some good honey that comes from down in South Alabama. We call it LA, Lower Alabama.
Lower Alabama. How about the Alabamans love that?
Yeah, from down in LA. There's some good honey that comes from South Georgia. And of course, all over Florida. But I don't know. There's something about this general area. Like I said, it's just it just doesn't ferment down to something that's enjoyable. It's not that good floral, mild floral character that you get from other wildflower honeys. And of course, we've got too much stuff growing here to have any, you know, single varietal honey. That would be nearly impossible. And you know, the biggest, I see probably maybe 200-300 acre farms is about as big as you see around here. So it's not really big enough to produce a single variety.
What are they growing on the farm?
Around here?
Yeah. What's the crop down there?
Around here, it's either going to be cotton, soybeans, or corn. Mostly cotton and soybeans. And I don't know what kind of honey that would make in particular, but like I said, you very seldom see a farm in this particular area that's big enough to provide a single source honey, a single variety. We're lucky, I guess. We are within a reasonable driving distance to get honey like from Eastern Tennessee or something. But when it comes to making mead, it's just so much easier to jump online. And you're going to pay a premium, mostly in shipping. Sometimes shipping charges cost as much as the honey. But if you're going to do this and you're going to make good mead, you've got to get good honey.
Yeah, and that kind of drives the overall investment up in your mead project as well, too, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's why I use buckets instead of stainless steel fermenters.
Well, I, you know, here again, we were cruising around. I was cruising around the Facebook thing here a while back. I don't remember what show this was on. This is probably maybe, going to say probably about 12 shows or so. Ryan can probably tell us. But I found this post by this guy. He was talking about a sizer, and of course, what really popped out at me was the mention of a bourbon barrel stave, and this was in a sizer that he was doing. This is Ryan. This is your first show with us, and the rest is history. Let's take a listen to what Ryan says about his bourbon barrel stave.
You put it on the Mead House Facebook. You made a traditional sizer with apple juice and honey and oaked it with a bourbon barrel stave.
That is correct.
How did that turn out?
Well, it's still in the process of working out right now. Used the 1 gallon batch of cider, used a pound of alfalfa honey. Brought it to 1065, fermented all the way down to 0.98. Have it on the bourbon barrel stave for about a week now. I'm going to leave it in for at least another week or so, and then I'm going to use some apple juice concentrate to back sweeten. You know, I have to bring up that sweetness just a little bit.
Okay. And it'll probably promote the apple flavor at the same time a little bit more, right?
Exactly. Yeah, but that, you know, just even 1 week in, that stave is starting to bring a nice oaky and just a little at this point, just a hint of that bourbon flavor and essence to it.
Yeah. Now, did you soak that bourbon barrel stave in any bourbon before you added it, or did you just you got it that way and put it right into your sizer?
Yeah, I got it from a homebrew shop that way, and I just sanitized it and put it in just as is.
So I got to ask you, Ryan, let's go back to that bourbon barrel stave sizer you made. Was it any good?
So far I've only done sampling of it, and let me just say it's something I will do again. It's good. The stave that I use, you know, when you buy a whiskey barrel stave, and I bought mine from the homebrew shop, you don't know what kind of whiskey it was in. You kind of, you know, you don't know how long it's been on the shelf, how much it's kind of dried out a little bit. Since then, I've decided on a few tweaks. But let me go back to the one that we're talking about there in the clip. You heard me say that what I was going to do was bring it up a little bit with some apple juice concentrate. I've tasted a little bit. I didn't like the bourbon flavor that it was imparting. And that's a strong way to say it, but it almost tasted thin, maybe a little stale, kind of like a bad rye. And again, I know that's being harsh, but if we want to be critical here and talk like you're the world's best third best beer judge. it's what I should say. So what I've decided to do with that batch is instead of trying to cover it with sweetness, you know, I think I'm going to let it, I'm going to add a little bit to it. I'm going to add, you know, an inch or two of vanilla bean and a cinnamon stick. And because I think those two flavors will play well off the bourbon. And actually, I might put a tablespoon of bourbon in with it too. I'm not ready to give up on it yet. And that's a problem I have. I know JD, a lot of times when you don't like something, you clean the drains of LA with, yeah, with your stuff.
Yep.
My issue is I keep trying to tweak it. I keep trying to tweak and tweak and tweak and tweak. And it's kind of like I never say die. I mean, so I keep trying with it. So that's where I'm at right now with it. What I will do in the, go ahead.
Well, I was going to ask you, have you considered, is it oak enough, or have you considered pulling that out and maybe soaking some cubes in some good bourbon that you know or you're familiar with, or is it past that point?
No, that's exactly where I'm going with the second batch. The second batch, instead, I'm gonna use cubes, charred oak cubes that I'll soak in the bourbon of my choosing, and I've got some going right now, in a Minnesota whiskey, and that's, you know, we always talk about the importance of, you know, quality in, quality out, you know, crap in, crap out, you know, that kind of thing. And I think it really starts, you know, I'm saying this after we listened to a clip of Mississippi saying how jealous he is when people say, you know, you get to know your beekeepers and that kind of thing. To me, you know, it's going back to the basics. I'm blessed with having a lot of great beekeepers around. I found a beekeeper that's got a good, nice, good wildflower honey. You know, I've tasted it, you know, I mean, it's before I bought it, you know, I bought a 5 gallon, 60 pound pail of it. You know, I mean, I know where that honey's coming from. Yeah. At the same time, I want to know the kind of bourbon or whiskey that's in my, that I'm going to use, you know, and all the way through. So I'm, going back to the start in that regard. So it's, to me, it is, it is something that I enjoyed, and it's something that I will continue. This bourbon barrel sizer, it just comes down to, starting with this base level, how you're going to do it. Now, the interesting other variable that I'm considering is, would there be a difference? And I don't, let me know what you guys think. Is there a difference if you add the oak cubes or stave during the beginning of fermentation? And we know it's sanitary because it's been in whiskey, nothing's going to live in that. So, would it change the flavor if you added it in secondary, or would it make no difference? You know, and I don't know, you know, the first time I did it, I added it during fermentation and it fermented out, and that might have been a little bit of the cause of the flavor, as opposed to dropping a few cubes in, you know, in secondary when fermentation, you know, is all but done.
I don't know, guys.
You know, I can tell you something about one of the characters you get from oak is the vanilla. That's one of the big characters. Even if it's not initially perceived as vanilla, it's from the vanillin that's in the wood. And I do know from some of my research that there are processes that take place during fermentation that will break down some of the flavor components of vanilla. Now, whether or not that holds true for the vanilla that comes from an oak stave or not, I don't know. But that's possible. Maybe that's why you didn't get, you know, the complete results you were looking for. It's also the reason that I never add a vanilla bean during fermentation, because the majority of it's going to get broken down. So something to consider.
Yeah.
That does make a lot of sense. You know, that,
if it was me, I think I would prefer to put it in secondary, because that way you, at least you can control the amount of flavorings and impact that you're going to get from the oak and the bourbon. Even adding the bourbon, I think it's pointless to put the bourbon itself in up front. That's something that you would want to add in secondary. I go back to my Braggot. My wife and I went on a bourbon hunt, and we scavenged around and came back with all different kinds of bourbon. And we settled on one in particular that we really liked, and that was Eagle Rare by Buffalo Trace. And we thought it was a very nice tasting bourbon. I soaked the oak cubes in it while, you know, during fermentation, added them into secondary. And right now it's in a keg. I took a taste of it the other day as it's carbonating. I'm liking it. For me, things like that would have to go into secondary. But Jeff Barron, you got another take on it?
I would absolutely say put that in secondary. I mean, anything, especially with oak flavor, which you guys that have been listening to the show know that I am a big fan of oaking mead. I would oak almost any style of mead to some extent or another, just because it does so many wonderful things as far as body and mouthfeel and just kind of rounding out the natural acidity and honey. It's a wonderful thing, but you can overdo it. And that's something you really need to be able to control and dial in. So whether you're going to soak it on oak, or you're going to do like a couple we mentioned towards the top of the show, do with their tannin additions or flavor additions, you've got to be able to control it somehow. And adding those flavors in secondary is really the best way to control it.
Aaron?
No.
You know, not sure there's much else I can add. I agree with everything you guys are saying. I think that's the way to be able to control it and really dial it in.
Yeah. Go ahead, Ryan.
Oh, I was going to say, you know, we were trading emails a week or so ago, and we were talking about what you do with leftover ingredients.
Yeah.
And with me, it comes down to is it an ingredient that will lose integrity over time, or is it an ingredient that's shelf stable? And if the ingredient loses integrity over time, I'm inclined to try to make an extract out of it. You know, like we talked about, you know, you can make a cocoa nib extract. You can make a hop extract. You can, you know, and hops are notorious for losing integrity over time unless you maybe properly freeze them or something. Anyway, what I was just thinking, I've never seen one. I've never heard of one. I don't even know if they exist. But, you know, could you make an oak extract? You know, and add, you know, I mean, I guess it'd kind of be like liquid smoke or something, you know, like you use, you know, in your barbecue, but, you know, just soaking oak for a very long period of time, you know, could you add that a tablespoon at a time? And I don't know the answer to that one.
Yes, I've actually done that.
It works. If you're gonna
an episode on YouTube, Northern Brewer, what is it? Brewing TV?
Brewing TV, yeah.
Yeah, there's an episode on their cider. Look up their cider episode, and they actually made an extract with oak. And rather than oaking the cider, they added a few dropperfuls.
Yeah, and look at it this way. If you're gonna soak oak in bourbon, all right, the result that you're going to get is a few ounces of really oaky tasting bourbon. Why couldn't you do the same thing in a 100 proof vodka? You're still going to get that oaky flavor, and a neutral spirit like vodka you know, isn't going to impart any flavor of that particular alcohol, but you're certainly going to get the oak big time. So, you know, if you think that's a load of crap, go ahead and soak your oak cubes in a little bit of bourbon and then drink the bourbon. You better have a plastic bucket by your side, too, when you do. So
that's, I had a friend that's over for messing around with some of the stuff I have in progress and just kind of working with some stuff. I pulled out my little bell jar full of oak tincture and gave him a half a shot of it. Yeah, no, that he was expecting it was some kind of a mead, and it,
yeah, and it's not going to taste like a nicely oaked bourbon either, I guarantee it. So, but
no, I drank a similar amount, and no, it is not pleasant.
No. So, this next clip, you know, when I first started making this mead, I was like hyper on all this sanitizing stuff, and I mean, there was a point where you could actually do heart surgery. In my kitchen, I was so freaking anal about it. But here's old JD talking about it.
I sanitized everything, the countertops, the stove, the floor, the ceiling, everything. And my kitchen, I mean, you could perform heart surgery in it. That's how fanatical I was about this. And I've calmed down quite a bit from there. But you know, I didn't want the risk. I'm giving this stuff to friends and relatives. I didn't want somebody's wife coming back and say, "Hey, you know, Bob died last night from drinking your wine." You know, so, but it's a good practice. You know, those of you listening to the show out there, you should get into the habit. Switch up your sanitizing material. You know, look at Star Sand, the Iota 4. And, you know, this metabisulfite, which you get at your local brew shop. You know, if you use those three, you're pretty well set. I know there are probably other products out there on the market I'm not familiar with, but those are the three that I am. And it's good practice to get into, and we highly encourage you to do that. So
there is one more warning that I want to throw out as long as we're talking about this. The sulfite-related sanitizers, you do want to be careful with the amount you use. Yes. It's actually common to use a sulfite in the winemaking industry as well to kind of stabilize the mead. The problem with sulfites, though, is that there's a small segment of the population that's very sensitive to sulfites, and it can give them very strong headaches. It's not a large segment of the population, but those that are affected by it are affected very powerfully by a very small amount of it. So,
a couple of things out of this, guys. I want to throw it over to Jeff and then to Chris. Jeff, you're talking about metabisulfite and how actually dangerous that could be to people who have an allergic reaction, even, or it can cause people to get these headaches. And then we'll throw it over to Chris. Chris, because you know he's a doctor, he's a surgeon. It's a common practice in hospitals apparently to rotate sanitizing material. But Jeff, talk about the metabisulfite thing again. Let's kind of reiterate on that.
Sure, and this applies not only to metabisulfite, but also to the use of sulfite-based sanitizers as well, just as a precautionary tale, because I used to rinse my balls in sulfite before I bottled, before I moved over to using predominantly Star Sand. There is a really small part of the population that's very sensitive to sulfites, and they can get some ridiculously bad migraine-style headaches, even from a very small concentration of sulfite in the final product. I've even heard of some judges having problems with sulfited wines or meads in competitions as well. So it's just something to be aware of. Not everybody has a problem with that. Most of the population doesn't, but there is that small section of the population that is going to be sensitive to it.
Yeah. Now, is metabisulfite a sanitizer that you have to rinse?
Well, the metabisulfite is actually the addition we use to inhibit yeast for stabilization. I don't think that's the same as the sulfite solution that I was using as a sanitizer, and I want to say that was not a rinse sanitizer. So much as just a drain sanitizer.
Yeah. Let's go to Chris. You know, Chris, your experience in the in an operating theater, being a surgeon, you had talked of one. You know, it might have been on the show too. You know, we were talking about sanitizers, and it might have been you that brought up just prior to me talking about it here on that clip. The fact that hospitals rotate sanitizing solutions or sanitizers periodically for a specific reason, right?
Most of the ones that I'm aware of do, usually on either a 4 or 6 month rotation. All microorganisms, all living things adapt. And the smaller and the simpler the organism is, the faster it adapts. It's much the same reason that bacteria will become resistant to certain antibiotics. So, you know, that's what we're fighting is the microorganisms. And if you use the same sanitizer for a long period of time, the ecosystem within your home or your brewing environment will eventually adapt to that, and you may start to get infections. So it's a good idea about every 6 months or so to rotate, to use Star San and then switch over to iota 4. As far as the sulfite solution, you can use the metabisulfite, but it is a rinse. It does need to be rinsed. And the dosage for that for sanitation purposes is 1 Camden tablet per cup of water. And, so you can crush up, 1 tablet in a cup of water, dissolve it, put it in a spray bottle, spray things down, and then use whatever water you're going to brew with. Use that same water to rinse. If it's clean enough to go in your beverage, it's clean enough to rinse your equipment.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's good information to know, and probably a good practice to get into. Would it be okay if you just rotated two of the, let's say you just had iota 4 and Star San, and if you did that every 6 months, would you be safe at that point, do you think?
You would be much better than using just one, yes.
Yeah.
I very seldom use sulfite solutions for anything other than stoppers and the seals on my bucket lids. And for those of you who use Star San regularly, if you use rubber stoppers or rubber seals or gaskets, if you've ever made up a Star San solution that was a little bit too strong, you already know where I'm going with this. You will get the most awful rotten egg smell because the acid in the Star San will start to break down the rubber. And if you don't believe me, go mix up some Star San at a little bit higher concentration than you should and soak a rubber stopper in it. And that once that smell, once that odor gets into your mead, it will not come out. You might as well chuck it down the drain. So
you suggest using what, silicone material, silicone stoppers at that point?
Yes, you can,
right?
Use if you can get silicone stoppers, that's the perfect solution to it. But I've got a lot of rubber stoppers that I still use that are perfectly good stoppers. And so I usually will just keep a bottle of either sulfite solution or iota 4, and I use that exclusively on my stoppers, and the lids to my buckets have these little rubber seals, gaskets around them, and I use it on that as well. just to prevent, because sometimes I make up star sand a little bit stronger than normal. But it will definitely break down that rubber into an awful egg smell.
Interesting and good advice. Well, guys, it's been 33 shows, gosh, it doesn't seem like, it's been that long, but you figure 33 weeks is, how long we've been going at this. And, actually just a little bit longer, because I think we've had a couple of breaks in there already. But it's been a hell of a lot of fun. Just wanted to kind of recap on some of the older shows, some interesting things that I thought we talked about. And there's a whole lot more. And for listeners who are just tuning in for the first time, themeadhouse.com. They're all piled up on our website. You can go to iTunes and get them. You can go to Stitcher Radio and get them. You can go to Podcastpedia and get them. They're out there, and they're out there everywhere. So let's finish off tonight, guys. I know that there was an idea we were tossing around, trying to hook up some recipes as a, kind of a Christmas gift for all of our listeners. And we wanted to put some stuff out there that, you know, that we've had some pretty good luck with. And I know, Chris, you've got something planned for the Christmas week. What's your plan there for our listeners?
Well, I've been promising for a long time that I was going to get this heart murmur recipe out there. I've just got to get it typed up and sent to you so you can post it. But that's going to be my Christmas gift. This is a long-term project that I've done so many test batches on, and I think I finally got it down to where I wanted it. So that's going to be my contribution.
And this is, if you can break it down just a little bit, this is kind of a this is a pseudo, not even a pseudo, this is kind of a modified project that Ken Schramm had done, correct?
Well, it's modeled after his most famous mead, which is the Heart of Darkness. And, you know, he grows all of his own fruit, and he knows all the right proportions and everything. And I set out, because we can't get it here. And even when he makes it, it's sold before it's bottled. So, I mean, literally it's gone the day it's released usually. So it's almost impossible unless you live within driving distance of his meadery. You can't get a bottle of it.
Yeah.
So I wanted to find a way to make something as close as possible that everyone could do. And I have this really big obstacle. I've never tasted it. So how do I make something that's as close as possible when you've never tasted it? So, you know, this was ambitious right from the start. So I went online and I read every tasting note and every review that I could find on the Heart of Darkness. And I called people who have had it. And, I mean, I did everything I could possibly do. And at the end of the day, I weeded out all the fluff and I found all the common denominators. What are the things that everyone seemed to say about this mead that everybody had in common about it? And I came up with this handful of descriptors for it. And I knew the ingredients, so it all came down to proportions and balance and how much of each thing do I use and sweetness levels and all this kind of stuff. So it took a lot of experimental batches to finally get it dialed in. Yeah, a bunch.
I've known Chris for, oh God, Chris, it must have been a couple of years, at least a couple of years.
This goes
way back to when I was producing the show for Got Mead Live, And Chris, this guy Chris, was always calling in. He was always calling in the show. You'd see a few postings now and again on the forums over there from Chris. But when we launched the show, Chris would call in, and it was just within several weeks. He starts talking about this heart murmur thing. And this went on it just went on and on and on. I mean, it got to the point where everybody on the show recognized the phone number that was coming in. We knew that it was Chris coming from Mississippi, and we knew at some point he's going to talk about this heart murmur thing. Now I can verify that he has worked and worked and worked batch after batch after batch on this heart murmur thing. So I'm telling you, if you're lucky enough to get a bottle from him, it's going to be good. I guarantee it.
Well, let's don't go that far. I got it to where I thought it needed to be. And, you know, one of these days when I get to taste a batch of the real Heart of Darkness, I may be totally surprised. But I honestly believe that I've taken commonly available ingredients that anyone can get from the store, and I've created the best Melomel that can be made using those particular ingredients based on the descriptions that I've read of the Heart of Darkness.
Yeah.
Now, whether it's like the Heart of Darkness, I'm sure it's not. I think this is as good as you're going to get with store-bought ingredients. So yeah. We'll leave it at that.
We used to do the after show too on that other show. And I know that a few times I heard comments like, God, that Chris, he's obsessed with that Heart of Darkness thing or that heart murmur thing. Mm-hmm. So it has been an obsession, hasn't it?
Yeah, I mean it's arguably the most famous mead being produced today.
Yeah.
He makes usually one batch a year at harvest time when he harvests his fruit. He pits all of his cherries by hand, he picks all of his fruit. You know, it's difficult to replicate something like that just by running down to the store and buying some juice or something. You're never going to get, and not to mention his, 20 some odd years of mead making experience.
Yeah.
You're not going to replicate something like that. And I know you can't, but it's not really so much of an obsession as it is a challenge. I like a good challenge. And yeah. What better challenge to take on than to try to make something that is probably the most famous and expensive mead being made today that you've never even tasted. Yeah. And you want to, you know, that's like the ultimate challenge. So it was all in fun. And I think I got a pretty good bottle of mead out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, guys, the music's queued up. That, pretty much brings us to the end of our show here tonight. We're going to be off for a couple of weeks, and I want to remind everybody, all of our listeners, hey, have a very Merry Christmas. Be safe out there. To our crew here on the Mead House, man, what a time we've had. Take a look back from where you came and keep a good eye out to where you're going. I want each and every one of you guys to have a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. When we come back, I know we've been wanting to talk about the leftovers. And I think that's going to take a pretty good chunk of the show. So I want to save that for when we come back. But other than that, like I said, Chris, Aaron, Ryan, and Jeff, Merry Christmas, guys. And a Happy New Year.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas.